From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowain in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, how our brains store memories. Dr. Barry Gordon runs the memory clinic at Johns Hopkins University. He says people who can't seem to remember things they used to might not be suffering from memory impairment, but rather data overload in the emerging information age. Gordon's new book is Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the reissue of Hal McCusick's Now's the Time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Police in Charlotte, North Carolina, have arrested a teenage girl in connection with last week's fire at a black church. Her arrest comes as pastors meet with federal officials about their investigation of more than 30 church fires across the South. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Charlotte police say they've arrested a 13-year-old white girl for setting the fire that destroyed a wooden sanctuary at the Matthews Merkland Presbyterian Church last Thursday. Police say the Charlotte fire is not connected to a series of church burnings that authorities believe are racially motivated. And there's two more. Authorities in Greenville, Texas, are questioning three white men in connection with suspicious fires that damaged two black churches in the North Texas town last night. Meanwhile, a group of pastors from African-American churches are in Washington to express dissatisfaction with federal, state, and local investigations of the fires. The pastors say many of the probes have focused more on church members and clergy than on outside suspects. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin today pledged that federal investigators would work to win the trust of the black community. This is Debbie Elliott reporting.
The court-martial of an Army sergeant accused of shooting members of his own unit opened today in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Tanya Harris of member station WFSS reports.
Opening statements in the court-martial of Sergeant William Kreutzer have begun. The Fort Bragg soldier pleaded guilty in May to opening fire on 1,300 soldiers in the 82nd Airborne Division last October, killing one and wounding 18 others. The parents of the Clinton, Maryland native say their son sought psychological help from Army officials prior to the shooting and that the Army was made aware of threats he made that he could harm himself or members of his unit. The remarks could show premeditation or that Kreutzer had a mental condition the Army failed to deal with. If Kreutzer is convicted, he'll face a mandatory minimum sentence of life in prison or he could get the death penalty. The court-martial is expected to take about a week. For National Public Radio, I'm Tanya Harris in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
British Prime Minister John Major opened Northern Ireland's peace talks today. Sinn Féin, the ally of the Irish Republican Army, was not there. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams won't be allowed to attend until the IRA resumes a ceasefire. Adams went to the talks anyway to dispute the right of the conferees to exclude his party.
We are here not to protest, but to assert our right and the right of those who we represent to be part of the inclusive dialogue which is necessary to build a peace settlement.
The Irish Republican Army ended its truce in February when members set off a truck bomb in London that killed two men. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 30 points at 5,666. Trading's heavy. This is NPR. At least five Israeli soldiers were killed in southern Lebanon today. Six more were wounded in a shootout with pro-Iranian guerrillas. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Hezbollah said the attack was in retaliation for what it called the massacre of civilians in Nabatea during Israel's operation in Lebanon in mid-April. At least seven civilians, including several children, died in that Israeli bombardment. Hezbollah said members of its military wing sneaked into the area Israel calls its security zone in South Lebanon and attacked an Israeli foot patrol with machine guns and rockets. Israel Radio reported Israel today shelled Hezbollah targets in villages in South Lebanon. Reports from Lebanon said a Lebanese army soldier was killed and several civilians injured. Hezbollah charged Israel with violating understandings reached after the April operation and warned there could be more Katyusha rocket attacks on northern Israel. The increased tension in South Lebanon comes a day after Palestinian guerrillas killed two Israelis in a drive-by shooting in central Israel. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Alaskan residents who fled the Big Lake wildfire may get to return home today if they have a home to go back to. The fire burned about 37,000 acres. More than 350 structures were destroyed, and 1,800 people ran to safety. Firefighters hope to have the blaze encircled by tonight, but there is weeks of work ahead. They'll have to put out hot spots that are still burning underneath the peat and moss that cover much of the area. The Southern Baptist Convention is discussing whether the Walt Disney Company is anti-family. The country's largest Protestant denomination is holding its annual meeting in New Orleans this week. Some members don't like some of Disney's activities, like offering insurance benefits to the partners of gay couples. Critics are also unhappy with some of the racier movies distributed through Disney subsidiaries. Several Baptist leaders are calling for a boycott of Disney, but many of them admit the boycott idea probably won't work. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen in for Terry Gross. See if this sounds familiar to you. You're introduced to someone for the first time, and a moment later, you can't, for the life of you, remember their name. You routinely search your apartment in a frantic hunt for your keys. You look up a number in the phone book, and just before you dial, that number evaporates. You're in mid-sentence, and a word, even a whole thought, just disappears, as if into thin air. Or you're at work, and you're seized with the thought, did I lock the front door? Did I turn off the stove? And you can't remember. Neurologist Dr. Barry Gordon says that memory lapses are a common experience. He's director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University and author of Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. He says our brains are not really designed to process, store, and retrieve all the information that bombards us daily.
Our brains are not like little pocket notebooks, unfortunately. They weren't designed to handle lists of names and numbers. And they also weren't designed to juggle so many things at once or take in information from so many different channels that's competing with itself. You may be seeing something that says one thing. You may be hearing something that says another while you're even driving along doing something entirely different. And that isn't something that's very natural for us. And as a result, one of the most common complaints I hear is that people think their memory's slipping, but what they're really doing is not being able to pay attention. They're not able to capture it as it's running on by them because their brains weren't designed to grab it and hold it the way a tape recorder or VCR could.
Well, what kind of a world are our brains designed for and our memories designed for?
Well, it looks like our brains and our memories were designed for the world we inhabited about 40 to 100,000 years ago or a little bit before that time, when our anatomically modern ancestors were being formed or selected out. And as far as we can tell, that was a world of mostly hunter-gatherers. People would go out and hunt, find whatever food is near you, grab it for the day, maybe put in a little reserve, but not a lot. It was a world where probably groups of people were no more than 40 or 50. And every once in a while, you'd wander around, get together, meet up with a larger group. But you wouldn't have to remember more than 40 or 50 people well in your lifetime, because that's all you'd ever see. You'd have to remember important things like where trees were, what direction you were going in, and how to come back from a hunt and not get lost. But you certainly wouldn't have to remember your zip plus four or your PIN or your Social Security number or the thousandth person you just met at a party.
Let me ask you then to take us through the brain process that takes an event and then stores it as memory. What happens in the brain?
Well, there's really three basic processes at first to think about. One is getting it in, because not everything that runs by us and the outside world gets inside of our head. So while you think you're seeing a lot, you're not seeing everything that happens. While you think you're hearing a lot, you're not hearing everything that happens. What gets into your head is partly determined by what you want to be there and what you expect to be there. If I suddenly switch to a foreign language, not much would get inside your head, even though, of course, the sounds are still there, because you just wouldn't have any way of capturing it. And that's an important point because people only perceive what they already know about. And people don't realize that you can't see things that you're not very familiar with, or you can't see them very well or understand them very well. So that's point number one. You have to get it in. The next step inside your head is you hold it there for a little bit. If it's sounds, you can hold them there for a couple of seconds. If it's sights, they get erased very quickly, within about a half a second, when a new sight comes in. Then you can make, in a sense, a decision. Should you keep it or should you throw it away? If you decide to keep it, you begin to burn it into the wiring of the brain. And there's a lot of processes at work there, but they all go under the term long-term memory. And what you've been doing now is converting from something immediate memory to a longer-term memory. You've been hardening it, gluing it down, cementing it. The reason you decide to keep something inside your head that way may be because you've heard it a lot, it's been repeated, or because it's important to you, so that the brain mechanism says, look, even though this has only happened once, this is awfully important, I've got to lock it in. And important to you can mean intellectually important or can mean emotionally important. So a scary episode, fear, taste, hunger, or desire, like I better learn this for the test kind of thing. Now, once you've gotten it locked inside your head, there's still another step involved in a memory, which is getting it out again.
Right.
Because very little of what we need to remember gets presented to us on a silver platter exactly the way we learned it. You know, that's part of the old trick in high school and college. You know, give the test question a little differently than they were taught it. And what that means is you've got to figure out from what you've been asked to remember the information you have in your head that might answer that question and come up with the best match. And we do those both automatically. There's an automatic search process that goes on where lots of different related thoughts light up. And there's also a conscious search process, which you know about because you say, who did I sit next to in third grade? Let me see. It was next to Bobby. Who was? Oh, that's it. And then you can go through that process mentally, and you know it's conscious. But a lot of the parts of that process are unconscious. And those three stages make up memory for us.
I'm curious whether a song is stored in one part of the brain and a picture in another.
Very much so. Although it's even more complicated than that. Because the picture is not even necessarily stored as a picture. The picture may be stored so that the shapes in the picture are saved one place, the colors in the picture are saved somewhere else, and the meaning of the picture for you, like a Rembrandt, a Titian, is stored somewhere else entirely. So when you think you're getting up a single picture inside your head, you're calling it up and so forth, as we often think in your memory, actually what your brain is doing, what your mind is doing, is pulling it out of lots of different boxes and assembling it quickly. You think you're looking at one thing, but it's actually lots of different things.
Can
I mention songs?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because songs are another interesting example of that. The melodies are different than the words, and yet the melodies can force the words along. So everybody has the experience of knowing how to hum a tune, but not remember what the words are, because they're saved differently.
Do memories change brain chemistry?
Well, memory is a change in brain chemistry in some ways, but it's not quite that straightforward. It would be like saying, is your car steel? You know, your car is steel, but it's not just steel. It's a lot of other things. And what memory is a change in the way nerve cells are connected with each other. And that can be because either a new connection has grown, or because a connection has gotten stronger, an existing connection has gotten stronger, or because an existing connection has been cut, it's been lost. And a lot of the reason for that change is chemical. There, new proteins are built, changes are made inside the nerve cell. But the fundamental change is actually kind of an electrical one in the way the nerve cells are connected with each other, which happens to be based in our brains on a lot of chemistry, but not purely chemistry. And there's another fallacy, though, because while memories may be chemical, that's a little bit like saying if you look at the picture tube on your TV set, the pictures you're seeing are dots. Well, they are dots, but the pictures are different than the dots. And the memories that we have, even though they're made out of chemical changes and connections between nerve cells, are actually the combinations of those patterns. They're not the individual little dots themselves. And that's a very big, important difference in memory. And it's one of the reasons our memories are different than the chemicals that make them up.
Most people cannot remember the first couple of years of their life and get bits and pieces, fragments of early memories going back to maybe when they're 3 or 4 or 5 years old. Is the development of memory then tied to the development of language?
Well, that particular part of it probably is. There's lots of reasons why kids can't remember. You can't remember being a kid.
Right.
One is you don't have a lot of experience. You don't have a lot of those slots I mentioned in which to put things. You know, everything's brand new, and so it's hard to remember. Secondly, it's very possible that the brain mechanisms for saving information are not very mature. Kids, of course, do have memories. Everybody who's shown a kid a Reese's peanut butter cup and then come back a little while later knows that the kid has a memory for it. But it's not as strong as it would be for an adult. They take a little longer to learn. But you hit on it, Marty. The most important thing is probably other things develop. And language is one of the most important things to develop. And memories that you have before you have language are just not saved the same way. And they get overwritten. They get crowded out by the language-based memories that come later. And all the other hopefully nice things that happen to you as you grow up, too.
Well, do scientists know why some people remember more or better or even more vividly than other people?
Well, we know why. I mean, collectively, we know why, but in any individual, it's hard to tell. We think that one reason why people have different memories is because their brains are different and their chemistry is different. There are so many different chemicals involved in saving memories that you and I may differ in them, just like you and I may differ in whether we have blue or brown eyes or dark or blonde hair or what have you. And it may make a difference in how we save different kinds of memories in different parts of our brain. And those are probably differences we're born with. There's another difference that you and I have, which is gender.
Right.
And that probably is responsible for both intrinsic differences in the brain and also later differences in hormones that change the way we save information. And then there's finally differences in interest and culture. You and I grew up interested in different things. We were encouraged to be interested in different things. We decided to be interested in different things. And we developed different aspects of our memory. And those three reasons are probably why people differ so much in their memories, even though many people aren't aware of how different people's memories are. They are vastly different.
What can you tell us about how men and women remember differently?
Well, I can tell you a bit about how men and women remember differently, but we're not sure it's because they're men or women versus men or women in our society, which is a big difference. There's a suspicion that the real sex differences between men and women are in a kind of mechanical memory and a kind of space memory, so that men are better than women in finding their way across large distances, whereas women are better than men in finding their way around more smaller spaces, more local spaces. And that's been thought by many people to represent something biologic, coming back from the 40 to 100,000 years ago when I mentioned before, because men were asked to go out and hunt, if you like, and it may not be so hard to go out and hunt, but finding your way back again is a big problem. And if you didn't have that skill, you rapidly got culled from the tribe. Whereas women were typically the people who hunted and gathered near the village, near the settlement. And that meant you had to really know your territory very well. And it's thought that some of those differences show up in people today. However, most of the differences between men and women today seem to be not biologic, but cultural and interest.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest is Barry Gordon, and he's the director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University and author of a book called Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Barry Gordon, and his book is called Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. Well, I don't know whether it's just the age of the people that I hang out with, whether it's friends or colleagues, most of them in their 40s and 50s, and a common complaint is the loss of memory, that they feel like they literally just can't remember things the way they used to when they were in their 20s and 30s. Is there a point in which the brain really just isn't working as efficiently when it comes to memory?
Well, the unfortunate news for all those who watch 30-something was that those people were already over the hill in terms of memory, or at least over the hump. But you know, among your friends, those complaints about memory may not mean that they actually have memory problems, at least coming from the brain. It is true that as we age, our mental processes get slower. And it is true that for some people in particular, our ability to form new memories gets worse. But for many people who are getting into their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, the memory problems that we complain about are not necessarily because our memories are bad, but because they're misused or abused, I should say. So think of what also happens as you move from your 20s into your 40s. Your responsibilities change. You begin to get better at certain things, and you begin to get overwhelmed, perhaps, by others. You're juggling more things. And juggling all those things is a big problem for memory. When you actually test people who are older or complaining about memory problems, you often discover that their memory strength is perfectly adequate. It's just not up to the task they've given it, which is juggling, you know, spouse, home, kids, two jobs, whatever, and trying to get some relaxation in the middle of all that.
Well, it seems as if it's the little stuff that starts to go. I used to be a fairly good speller, and now I'm watching my spelling deteriorate. I had a friend say recently that they got into a car with a colleague. They looked over at them, and they couldn't remember their name, and they work with them just about every day. I mean, this is kind of nuts and bolts stuff that seems to be slowly evaporating.
Well, unfortunately, there is a little bit of that slow evaporation. It's not as bad as we might think if you measure it objectively, but it's certainly annoying. And some of it's definitely coming from the brain. Some of it's coming because, as I said, brain connections are slowing down, so that what the name that used to pop into your head in a quarter of a second before now takes half a second or three quarters of a second, and you can see, you can feel that difference. And it means that the mechanism jams because what it expects to happen on time isn't happening on time. The problem with reading, or spelling rather, is an interesting one because when you think about it, it may also be a case of not using it and so forth, so therefore losing it, because we're really pushed in our spelling when we're younger. When we get older, we have a lot more props and we may not push it anymore. And I don't know whether people are correcting your spelling the way they used to.
I hope not.
Maybe they don't want to mention anything to you.
That spell checker
helps too. Well, that's part of it. Some of that may be simply because we're letting some abilities atrophy a little bit. I mean, your ability to speak a foreign language is also dropping, but you never complained about that because you may not have been using it. I don't know in that case. The problem with names is an interesting one because names are just about, the inability to remember names is just about the most common complaint that people have. But they ought to take heart in a couple of things. One is that it's almost certain that ordinary people's inability to remember names means that they actually know those names somewhere, which is, of course, people's everyday experience. They know that person. They know what their name is. The moment they hear it, they'll be able to say it. And what's going on there, we think, is actually a traffic jam. It's because you know too much. You may think you're only looking at Brian sitting in the car, but in fact, you're thinking of all the other Brians you may have heard about, okay? And as a result, your memory has a traffic jam because it turns out there's only one exit. Only one name can slip through. And so you feel this jam. You know that you can unlock the jam if you hear sometimes the first couple of letters, okay, or the first sound, or if you walk away. If you walk away and stop thinking about it, what happens is everything begins to die down. The jam begins to thin out, and the one that's supposed to come out can slip on through because it's still the most important, the most active of all. So the people tend to block on the names of people they actually know reasonably well. People that you don't know hardly at all, well, you know that why you don't know their name. And people that you know extremely well, well, they manage to make it through that traffic jam. It's only the people you know moderately well that you might block on. Although sometimes people block on even their own names, as has happened to me once, maybe more than once, but I only remember once.
Well, let's talk about that party or that business meeting where you are there to meet people. Someone introduces you and say, "This is Mary Smith." They say the name out loud, but you don't remember it. Why not? I mean, it's been spoken out loud. You're there to meet somebody, but you can't remember her name.
Well, if you're describing the very common situation where the moment the person says the name, it evaporates from your mind, then what you're describing is because you're hearing so much else. Remember what's going on at that party. A lot of conversation, a lot of background noise. You may not realize it because your mind is automatically filtering that out. It's the buzz of the conversation. But that noise is wiping out the memory of Mary Smith inside your head. And I only remember Mary Smith, by the way, because I wrote it down. So I don't have a super memory. I cheated. All right. So suppose you can overcome that. You manage to avoid that erasure from all that extra noise. Well, then the next problem is you're often probably thinking about who else you're going to meet. What's Mary Smith? What about this other person that introduced you? Look at the guy in the corner. All right. Isn't that your boss's wife? Isn't that your boss's ex-wife over there? And there's so many things that typically crowd people's minds in that situation that locking from immediate memory to permanent memory that I talked about earlier doesn't happen.
So even in that couple of seconds, that name is lost.
That name is lost, and it depends on how it's lost as to whether you can ever get it back again. If you've repeated it to yourself a couple of times, or if you have a good memory, it may have gotten into permanent memory but not be very strong, which means you can recreate it. You may think, gee, she had a common name, and one of them was the name of the captain who met Pocahontas. Smith. Mary Smith. I don't know if that's true, by the way, but I remember a Smith from back in the Plymouth Rock era anyway, so maybe that was the closest I could come. All right, that's what happens if you have a weak memory, but some memory that... But if it's gone from immediate memory, it's gone.
Hmm.
It's just gone. And the only thing you can do is look a little sheepish and apologize and or go back and say, gee, I couldn't quite catch your name because of the noise, and then make it a point to repeat it to yourself or write it down. Or both.
And that's obviously what you need to do to lock then that name in your brain so that you can retrieve it when you need it.
That's right. And locking it in means hearing it in the first place, repeating it, trying to get your long-term memory revved up. For some people, that involves making associations. For other people, it's just a matter of brute memory force. And, of course, it also may involve going off in the corner somewhere and jotting down a note if the person's really important.
Let's talk about an experience I know that everybody's had. We call it a deja vu, that distinct feeling that something has happened before. And it feels obviously very familiar, but there's this little voice inside your head that says, well, this couldn't be happening. What's happening with the mind, with the brain on this?
What's happening is there's two voices inside your head. There's a feeling of familiarity that happens when you see something. Your mind instantly tries to compute, is this something I've seen before? But there's also the more detailed analysis your mind makes of whether that's actually something you've seen before. Does it connect with anything else in your mind accurately? What we think is going wrong in that feeling of deja vu is that little channel, that little highway that's familiarity, is tickling you. And you get the feeling, because of similarities of what you're seeing with what you've got already stored inside your head, that it is familiar. But, of course, that other little voice that's saying, no, you didn't do it, it didn't happen, you haven't been here before, that's the voice of the other channel, the channel that's making the detailed comparison. And we're built like that probably for a good reason, because in a sense, one is the emergency channel. The quick one, you've got to decide real fast if that pattern of stripes moving in the underbrush is just your cat or a bigger cat that may not like you. And that other detailed one that we've acquired later. But it does mean that every once in a while, and in fact, very frequently for people, they get this tickling feeling that's just wrong, and you have to use your reason to say no.
Dr. Barry Gordon will be back with us in the second part of the show. He's director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University and author of Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You said, I love you. Remember.
Coming up, can our memories be trusted? Dr. Barry Gordon says our minds have a way of shredding details, and so-called recovered memories may not be what they seem. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue by saxophonist Hal McCusick.
A lonely spot, and after I learned to care a lot, you promised that you'd forget me not, but you forgot to remember. ¶¶
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let's continue our conversation with Dr. Barry Gordon about how memory works and why we're so forgetful. He's director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University and has just written a new book on the subject called Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. Can memory be trusted?
Well, yes and no. It depends on, it's like asking, can you trust your children? You can trust them up to a point, but I don't know if I'd completely trust them with the family jewels or fortune, you know, but sure, a dollar now and again is fine. The problem with our memories is that it's not perfect. Nobody's memory is perfect. Our memories, unlike computer memories, were not built to be perfect. They were built to make kind of creative errors, productive, informative errors, but errors nonetheless. So when I talk to Marty on Fresh Air, there's other Martys kind of crowding at the periphery of my mind that I might be not really confusing you with, but that memory is tickling and memory may be confusing with. Unlike a computer where every Marty is distinct, has a different slot on the hard drive. Now, the other problem with our memories, though, is that we judge how good our memories are by feeling a familiarity. How familiar does this feel? And unfortunately, even if you repeat something that's not true to yourself often enough, it'll become familiar to you. So that you'll suddenly begin to think, or not suddenly, you'll think, this is real. And that's how people can convince themselves. As a result of all this, as a result of the way that memory kind of molds itself around whatever's coming in and changes what's inside the memory store and how we don't always get it out of the memory the way it came in, the notorious, you know, passing along a message from one person to another type of effect, our memories can be trusted to get the gist of things relatively well. But the details often get shredded beyond belief. They're sometimes completely invented or modified. And we may not have the slightest clue that that's not right because it feels right to us.
Well, it certainly raises questions about courtroom procedure where a courtroom would proceed based on evidence and testimony that's based on recollection. And even in the most basic courtroom procedure, it seems to me what you're saying is that you can't necessarily trust somebody's memory.
Well, that's correct. And at times, that's actually been tested directly in the courtroom, in a sense. And, you know, I'm blocking his name myself, but there was a famous figure from Watergate who was alleged to have a tremendous memory. John Dean. There it goes. All right. And as it happened, at the Watergate hearings, he rattled off chapter and verse of what happened. But unknown to him, Nixon, of course, had been taping the conversations. So it was possible later to see what John Dean had remembered so well, he thought, versus what had actually happened. And it turns out John Dean's memory was not that perfect. He had the gist of events down. He had a pretty good idea who did what to whom or who wanted to do what to whom. But he didn't have the specifics and he didn't have the conversations down verbatim. That's not the way anybody's memory works, or hardly anybody's memory. There are a few people that can do that, but hardly anybody. And yes, it does raise questions, and it raises questions especially in those cases of so-called recovered memories now, because unfortunately they are exactly the kind of situation where you can least trust a memory or so-called memory. If a person hasn't remembered something at all, I'm talking about the situation where someone says that they've had no memory of sexual abuse and then can get it, somehow recover it, or some other such thing related to that. And unfortunately, if people have no memory of anything, and it happened in childhood, and if they try to get back a memory through hypnosis or group therapy or imagery sessions or anything like that, those are exactly the situations that bring out the falsest, most invented memories. And unfortunately, those are also the situations that make the memory seem so vivid, they feel as though they've happened to you.
But also based on what you're saying about how the brain works and how memory works, it also could be true that someone could recover a true memory of something that happened in their childhood.
In fact, it could be true. The problem is that, you know, if it's half right and half wrong, how can you trust it? And unfortunately, the evidence suggests that in many of those situations, it's more like 95% wrong, maybe even worse. So that it's possible, first of all, that someone could have had childhood sexual abuse and not remembered it at all. It's possible they could have had it and had a false memory of it, so what that happened to them wasn't what they remember. And all those different combinations. The best evidence right now suggests that if there's allegations of childhood sexual abuse, then recovered memories are not, in my opinion, fit to be used as evidence. Other evidence has to be looked at, and just a so-called recovered memory alone isn't good enough. There's too many things that go wrong with it.
Well, one of the familiar complaints that one hears is people saying, oh, I must have early Alzheimer's disease because I feel like I can't remember anything. But I know that the scientists are learning more and more about how Alzheimer's works and how it affects the brain and certainly what effect it has on the memory. Can you get us up to speed on where some of this research is taking us?
Well, I think from the point of view of people who are worried about their memories, where this research is taking us is in the following. Ask yourself, is what I'm forgetting very important? Is it happening all the time? All right. Are other things going wrong with me? Is my judgment bad? Is my personality changing? Can I dress myself or drive? And how fast has this been happening? Is it happening over the last year or so? And more importantly, don't ask yourself these questions. Have someone else ask these questions. Because many people, in fact, the majority of people with Alzheimer's, tend not to ask those questions. They tend not to appreciate that they have a problem or how bad that problem is. So if you're really worried about your memory, our rule of thumb in medicine is you probably don't have a memory problem from Alzheimer's disease or something like that. Now, you can have a memory problem from aging. Where research is now is that, yes, there are people as they get older who have problems with their memory. There's a lot of people who complain about their memory, as we talked about, and some of those actually have problems with their memory. And the problems that occur with aging, fortunately, are different than Alzheimer's disease. They tend not to be as severe. They tend not to be as frequent. Nothing else goes wrong with your intellect or your judgment or whatever. And they tend to be slow so that people with age-related changes can say, you know, over the last couple of years, I've been having a problem, but it's been about the same problem. Or their spouse will say, it's about the same problem for the last couple of years.
Can damaged nerves that affect memory, can they be brought back to life, so to speak?
Well, we don't know in every condition, but I can tell you a different kind of answer, which is we now know that even in the adult, nerve cells have much more capacity to regrow and establish connections than we ever thought they did. It's been known for a long time that nerve cells in the brain, or it was thought to be known, that nerve cells in the brain don't ever grow, that they don't ever get new again. You don't develop new nerve cells after you're a child. It's now actually thought that it's possible that we might be able to develop new nerve cells, and even more importantly, that we might be able to stimulate the nerve cells we have, that they continue to be flexible through our life. And that's an important area right now of neuroscience research.
Are there drugs or herbs that can improve memory, some kind of equivalent to so-called smart food?
Well, let me tell you one answer to that,
okay.
Which is all the foods you knew you weren't supposed to eat can help improve your memory. M&Ms, chocolate in general, milk if you're hungry. The basic problem is that you can improve your memory 20 to 40% maybe by just placebo anyway. Hmm. On the average, if you think your memory is going to get better, for many people it will get better just because you feel better, you feel more confident. Now, whether any food can be more specific beyond that is not completely clear. It's pretty reasonable that foods that carry an extra jolt of something, caffeine, for example, or chocolate with all its fat, sugar, and caffeine-like compounds, can make you feel more energetic and improve your mental ability and your memory as a result. Whether any foods have specific effects on memory really isn't known. Those over-the-counter or so-called mind drugs or whatever you mentioned, those mind cocktails, brain cocktails,
yeah.
Some of them contain things that we know to be active, things like caffeine. And some of them just contain lots of sugar and whatever. But none of them contain anything that's thought to be tremendously effective as a mind drug. And actually, I'd be a little worried if I found such an agent. I wouldn't want to be the first on my block or maybe even in my country to try such a drug.
Why not?
Well, the reason is this. There's an enormous number of chemicals in very precise balance inside of our heads. We often forget how balanced we are. We may talk about, I'm unbalanced, but actually our brains, our bodies are the products of hundreds of millions of years of fine-tuning, really fine-tuning, much more than Detroit ever puts into its automobiles. And if you begin to throw drugs in there, you might screw up things, to put it mildly. Now, it's one thing if you have a medical condition and you want to accept the benefits for the risks because there's a real reason. But taking drugs that are unproven as to what they are, putting them inside your head, in a sense, by taking them, That's a little bit more radical than I, as a conservative physician, would like to endorse.
Well, what about mental exercises, little mind games you can play just to keep your memory, your brain in shape?
Well, that's a different story, and I certainly endorse mental mind games or exercises. But one thing I'd say about them is make them exercises that you enjoy. Just like you shouldn't have to necessarily push on a treadmill or an exercise machine. Or rather, if you do, you know it's not going to be very effective because you don't have your heart in it. If you're going to do mental exercises, do something that you really like. It'll turn out you get the same benefit from it. In fact, you get more benefit from it because you put more into it. And also, if it's something you like, it's probably something you may also need or can use so that you'll have a double improvement. Mind games can certainly help. There's certainly evidence that if you don't use it, you'll lose it, and other evidence that if you use it, you'll make it stronger. But don't just do it for the sake of doing it. If you don't like crossword puzzles, as I don't, then don't have to do crossword. You don't have to do crossword puzzles to build up your head.
My guest is neurologist Dr. Barry Gordon. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Barry Gordon directs the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University and is author of a new book on memory. Does memory ability change throughout the day and either ebb and flow depending on whether we eat or whether we're tired or wide awake?
It definitely changes over the day. Now, some people already know that they're morning people versus evening people. So they know that their memories and their whole minds will work better, say, in the morning than in the evening. And memory also changes by whether you're hungry, tired, interested, what you've eaten, how much you've eaten. So a little bit of food may help your memory. A lot of food may put you to sleep. Definitely is a change. And one reason why in some memory testing, we try to aim for testing people at the same time each day.
Just for that kind of consistency.
To make it more consistent.
I'm curious, though, whether, and let's say someone wanted to do this, you wanted to memorize poetry. Would something like that literally help your memory, you think?
Well, it'll help your memory for certain types of poetry. One of the problems with mental abilities, which is also one of their virtues, is that the training is very specific. Just like athletes know that if you train for one type of sport or one type of activity, it doesn't necessarily help you in another type of activity because training can be very specific. So training for, say, the 100-yard dash doesn't necessarily help you in a 500-meter run. Mental exercises don't necessarily improve your memory overall. You will certainly learn how to organize poems in your head if you begin to try to memorize poetry. And you may learn a lot about Coleridge or Yeats or somebody else if you work on those particular poets. But it may not help you when you come to E.E. Cummings or a more modern poet because it may be a different meter, a different topic. And it'll be surprising to people to discover how much work has to go into it and how specific the results are.
There's an experience I think people have. Let's say they go to a family get-together, or they go to a high school or college reunion, and they begin to reminisce with their friends and family. And the more they reminisce, the more they remember. And I'm wondering what gets unlocked out of that very social event. All these, you know, childhood memories or whatever, all of a sudden become unlocked in that social environment. Have you looked at that?
Well, I haven't looked at it, but it's been looked at in many different ways. And it's not just the social environment. It's being with people that are familiar. It's getting back. Mentally, people set themselves back into that time. Just like when you hear a song from your teenage years, you may find yourself transported back to when you first were driving around and heard that song. Kind of the theme, I guess, of American Graffiti. What happens is very complicated. Much more complicated than the simpler types of memory that I've talked about. But they can be understood, we think, in much the same way. First of all, there are different clues. So there are things that are now happening that you haven't thought about. They've been hidden in the dusty corners of your mind, but you just never tried to find the doors for them because you never had to. Now suddenly people are coming, you're searching them out, you're remembering little bits and pieces, and you're also creating what's called a collaborative memory, which is a lot of what spouses do you know, when they're trying to remember, do you remember Jaime? Well, you're doing it for your high school. And what you're doing is people are filling in different pieces of the puzzle. Think of it like a jigsaw puzzle. And if lots of people are working on it and they're looking for different combinations, they're going to do it much faster to come up with the answer. And a lot of that is what happens. You provide a piece. Oh, it fits with somebody else's piece. They feedback those two pieces to you. You say, wait a minute, oh, I found this. And in some ways it's unconscious, and in some ways it's conscious. But the net result is you can recreate your high school years.
Is there a connection between depression and memory?
There's a definite connection between depression and memory. People who are depressed tend to complain about their memory, even though their memory problems, their memory abilities may not be a problem. But it also is true that severe depression can cause problems with memory. People won't remember as well. And they'll typically not remember as well the kinds of things that require effort to remember. It stands to reason if you're depressed, you won't put the mental effort into it. And that's one of the big things that's a problem when people get severely depressed.
Is there such a thing as a photographic memory?
Well, there is such a thing as people who have fabulous memories in different areas. And there are such things as people who have memories that almost seem as though they save photographic images of what they look at. That happens more commonly in children than it does in adults. And for some reason, it seems to fade as people get older. And it may be related to what we need as children versus what we need as adults. Although it would be nice in our world to have a photographic memory. It turns out, though, that most of the people, if you advertise in the paper and you advertise for people with photographic or fabulous memories, most of the people who show up in response to such an ad have perfectly normal memories. But every once in a while, there's a person who either thinks of themselves as perfectly normal and they discover they have a fabulous memory, or who knows they have a fabulous memory but just hasn't been flaunting it very much, keeping it kind of as a secret weapon. And there are such people. In my book, I describe a number of those. There's a fellow who couldn't forget stories, for example. I mean, literally, he didn't try to forget them. He could remember them perfectly well, to the punctuation. Anything he read, he could remember. But there's a lesson in this, by the way, in those people with fabulous memories. They're not universally fabulous memories. People with photographic memories may have terrible memories in other areas. They may have memories that look almost as if they forgot to bring film in other areas of their life. So that the fellow who couldn't forget stories and who had a fabulous memory in other respects couldn't learn the names of people that he met very well. He was like you and me, or me at least in that respect. As he said, that's not the kind of thing I do. If I was a politician, maybe I'd do that, but I'm not, so I don't. And he was perhaps showing a combination of his own genetic endowment plus his own interest. And we're all like that. It's amazing, by the way, what kind of memory you can develop. Because one of the other lessons of people with so-called photographic memories or fabulous memories is that a lot of them are made, not born. By relentless practice, you can really, really, really improve your memory. I quoted the number of 40,000%. I'm basing that on the fact that, you can remember maybe four people at a party normally if you walk in. But there are known people. There are people who are known to be able to remember 400 people at once as they're introduced to them. And it can be done. However, to do that, you really have to work at it for many, many years. And most people will find that degree of memory training, like being a weightlifter, isn't really useful in their everyday lives.
Have scientists figured out whether there is a connection between having a good memory and being intelligent?
Well, the evidence is having a good memory has nothing to do with being smart. While memory is spread out throughout the brain, there's not a single box that's memory. Being smart is different. It's using what memory you have in creative ways and anticipating and planning and everything else. And that actually has very little to do with memory. So it's very well known that there are people with fantastic memories who have only average IQs and other people who have super IQs whose memories are not very good by any standard at all.
How would you describe your memory?
Well, I've never been happy with it, but apparently it's been good enough to get me through medical school, a PhD, a position at Johns Hopkins, or whatever. Actually, a lot of my memory resides in either the note cards in my pocket, my desktop computer, or with my wife, Renee.
So someone has to hold something or someone has to hold your memory for you.
I like to think of it that way. I like to think I keep a finger on it, but they mostly hold it. Now, other people, however, tell me that's not true. They tell me that in my own areas, I have a good memory, but I never thought of it as a good memory. I just assume people can remember everything they've ever read.
And you can? Can?
Not everything. I can remember the gist of things for a long, long time, but I can remember the page they're on. frequently. But I can't remember the names of anybody I meet at a party without major mental effort, and usually by asking my wife.
Well, thank you, Barry Gordon, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Dr. Barry Gordon is director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University and is author of Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. This is Fresh Air. Americans are fond of recognizing regional differences. We like Southern cooking and talk about New York attitude. Discussing early jazz, experts speak of New Orleans style, Chicago style, or Kansas City style. But critic Kevin Whitehead says because the music got around mostly by way of widely distributed records, such distinctions got blurred in a hurry. A case in point is the music of alto saxophonist Hal McCusick. Kevin reviews a reissue of McCusick recordings from the 1950s.
Hal McCusick's music fits snugly into the style known as West Coast jazz. Cool jazz distinguished by a light, clean saxophone sound, pastel harmonies, and a whiff of classical counterpoint. Only thing is, McCusick grew up outside of Boston, and though he did spend time in Los Angeles in the 40s, by the heyday of West Coast jazz in the 1950s, he was based in New York, where he played on lots of studio sessions. Hal McCusick is the subject of a recent CD from Decca, called Now's the Time, 1957-58, taken from two LPs he recorded in Manhattan. It definitely sounds like music of that period, but to these ears it wears very well. There's something heartbreakingly melancholy about his restrained alto sax sound. On the earlier of these sessions, the pianist is Bill Evans. He plays in a leaner and more linear style than the soft-edged one he became famous for a little later. McCusick and Evans are a good fit, soloing back-to-back on Whisper Not. The star of Hal McCusick's 1957 album is arranger George Russell, an influential theoretician and gifted composer. His rewrite of the standard You're My Thrill is so radical there's barely a trace of the original tune, and it's so complex you have to remind yourself the band is only six pieces. Charlie Persip is on drums and Barry Galbraith on guitar. Fringer George Russell was born in Cincinnati, and back in the late 50s lived just east of the Hudson River. So how did these New Yorkers come to make this so-called West Coast music? In fact, the style was an East Coast phenomenon to begin with. It was inspired by Miles Davis's album Birth of the Cool, recorded in New York, and spearheaded in Los Angeles by, among others, Shelly Manne, originally a New Yorker, and Shorty Rogers, who was born in Massachusetts. Rogers' other big inspiration, by the way, was Kansas City bandleader Count Basie, who was from New Jersey. Moral: in a nation of transients, any regional style can come from anywhere.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is currently in Amsterdam. He reviewed the reissue Now's the Time by Hal McCusick on the Decca label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Alan Tu, with Kathy Wolf, Barbara Bogave, and Louisa Shafia. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support comes from Ferrer Straus & Giroux, publisher of Messages from My Father, a new memoir by Calvin Trillin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.